And one of the things that I wanted to cover again and a little bit was causality, because somewhere quite early in the retreat I said that it's one of the things that, if you're a Buddhist, then it's one of the things that Buddhists believe. If Buddhists believe anything, they believe in causality. And that there can sometimes be confusion about that, and particularly when it comes to karma. And yes, things happen according to causes, but karma is only one of the aspects of causality. It's not the only one. It's the one that humans have most power in. Dogs can create some karma, but not a great deal. Insects, less. Plants, none at all. Although gods can create karma, they don't usually bother. So, it's intentional action is karma. And the other aspects of causality that are enumerated, but not so clearly, they are enumerated in the scriptures, but not so clearly as in the commentary in the Abhidhamma, are things like physical causality, just ordinary physical causality. So something like gravity is accepted as an aspect of causality. The one that's most commonly mentioned is the weather. It's not your karma that the weather happens to be this way today. Yeah? How you respond to this is a question of your karma. Yeah? Because you can either get upset by it and rage against the clouds and say it should be bright and sunny. The fact that you're here is partly to do with your karma, because you intended to be here. Yeah? You intended to come to this particular room at this particular time. You could be in the south of France. Now that's an aspect. So you can see how the links of causality are linked together. There is space in this for things like accidents and being at the wrong place at the wrong time. Not all things that happen to you are the result of your karma. Not all things that happen to other people are the result of your karma. There can be other forces that are at work. I think the one that jumps out for me most, because I sort of grew up with this sort of thing, and when I was a teenager, it was something that was possibly discussed or earlier, was the thing about the kids that had whose mothers took the drug thalidomide. Yeah. Now, I don't actually believe that. The kids' karma, that their mothers took the drug thalidomide. Yeah? It was a drug that was around at the time. The mothers took it in good faith because it was supposed to help with, I can't remember what, something to do with pains. Huh? Morning sickness, okay. It was supposed to help with morning sickness. But what it actually did was inhibit the reproduction of cells. So it's actually a pretty good anti-cancer drug, which is being trialed for at the moment. But it was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the fetuses that happened to be in those wombs at that time were affected by the chemicals that were around at that time. And hence the beings that were born in ways that were distorted physically. Yeah? But I don't actually think that it was those kids' karma that happened. You know, how those people have grown up with it has been to do with their intention and has been to do with their karma. But the fact that they actually experienced that life, I don't think might not have had anything to do with their karma, actually. You know, what they make of it will be. I don't know, maybe for some of them, but I don't, in something like that, or in the case of, say, when there's a major accident, or the or a plane flies into a building in New York, or two planes do, then I don't necessarily believe that it's the karma of all those beings that die, that they die. And they happen to be at that time, at that place. Some of them maybe, but not necessarily so. Yes, they intended to be in that building, but the fact they didn't, you know, it wasn't some sort of fixed thing that they had to experience. Yeah? Which is what people tend to say when people say it's their karma. It's like saying that it's fixed that they experience that. There is supposed to be some karma that is fixed. If you kill your parents intentionally, then the Buddha suggests that you will go to hell. That's a fixed karma. There are a few other things that are fixed that you're unlikely to do, like injure a Buddha or kill an arahant. These sorts of things are fixed karma. Most other karma is not, other karma is not fixed on the whole. It's not a sure result. And to say that everything is the result of karma is the result of past karma. Everything that you experience, every pain, every movement, everything that you experience is the result of your past karma. In Buddhism, the Buddha said that is called a wrong view. It's called a wrong view. What it can then do, you see, because if you do believe that, then it's really, really difficult to do anything about anything. Is it? You know, it's like you're stuck. And then you can just look at other people and say, well, it's their karma. You know. And does that increase your sense of aliveness and that, your connection? Does that increase your sense of ease? You know, those beings that happen to be in Darfur at the moment, it's their karma. Can't do anything about it, it's just their karma. Now that is not actually a wise or compassionate response. The Buddha said only Buddhas can really understand karma. If you claim that you know that it's somebody's karma, then you're claiming to be a Buddha. He said that if you actually try to figure it out completely, your head will explode if you try to figure out karma. So unless you want to do that right now, then I'll leave it be. And the whole thinking about it doesn't actually help. Now there are other factors involved. Now, as I said, that there's physical causality. In the case of, say, the thalidomide people, they had the chemical, which is a physical causality, which interfered with the other causality, which is the way that seeds develop. That's accepted as a type of causality, which is independent of karma. Yeah? The way that seeds develop is independent of karma, if you interfere with. And, okay, if you interfere with seeds, then you can affect how they develop. But other factors will also affect seeds, like where you plant them. You know, you might decide to plant them in a particular place. Okay. But, you know, the way that they develop is nothing to do with karma. No. The way that they develop in places where there aren't humans about. You know, it's very, very sort of egocentric, actually, to feel that everything that happens to me is just to do with my karma. Yeah? It may or may not be. It may or may not be. Yes, things happen due to causes, but causes are not necessarily to do with karma. people can make mistakes. You can drop hot water on your... I didn't actually intend to drop the hot water on my hand. You know, yes, I happened to be carrying it, and yes, I was in a flurry when I was doing it. And yes, I didn't bother to run the hand under hot water. So, yes, there are certain consequences that come from what I did intend. But to say that this is just to do with my karma is not actually correct. There are many factors involved in the bringing together of something. So I hope that helps with the whole thing of causality. Any questions on causality right now? Yeah, there's an element of luck, an element of things that one, well, call it luck, but it means, you know, luck is also, it's not uncaused, but things can happen at the wrong time. You can be at the wrong time in the wrong place when the tree drops down. And that's just part of it, part of the uncertainty of life. Yes? Yeah, well, yeah, things happen due to causes.
So the causes, seed, they got planted now?
Well, no, an ordinary seed, if you're planting that's one way of talking about karma, is to try to treat them as seeds. And that's one way that people talk about karma, which can be helpful, but can be confusing. Because they can confuse what they call karmic seeds, which is one way that people talk about karma. It's not the way that the Buddha actually talked about karma, but it's the way that people have picked it up since. So they tend to think about karma ripening and seeds ripening. And the analogy that is given, okay, that I think this is in the things that if there are seeds, okay, and, you know, there are many, many acorns, right, from one particular tree. If every acorn from a particular tree grew into an acorn, we wouldn't have room to move here at Amaravati. Yeah? And some seeds, this is the old parable of the sower, isn't it, will fall on fertile ground, and some seeds won't, and some seeds will get eaten, and all this. And you know, then, and similarly with karma, not everything's actually going to come to any sort of fruition. Yeah?
So then the key question, I'm sure, must be, how do we ensure that the positive seeds that we plant, what are the conditions to making sure they come to fruition?
Yeah. Keep an eye out for it. Keep an eye out for them. You know, keep an eye out on your cultivation. Keep an eye out on what's growing in your garden. Yeah, what things you're encouraging, what things you're not encouraging. And the other thing about karma is that's also talked about is it happens in a context. Yeah, so, and the way that's put is that if, you know, if I put a teaspoonful of salt in here, yeah, and then pour the water in, it's, and then I drink it, yeah, it's going to taste salty, yeah. If I put a teaspoonful of salt in a swimming pool that's full of clean water, and then take a cup of that water and drink it, I probably won't even notice. And similarly with how the karma acts in the field of where it's being put. So if your cup of good karma is gigantic, yeah, got a swimming pool of good karma, then you happen to make some bad karma, it won't actually do necessarily very much. Yeah? Or the other way around. Yeah? So that's also something that can give an idea of how much effect a particular action will have in terms of karmic consequences. But as I say, if you try to figure it out, well, how much good karma have I got? What can I get away with? You're already draining your swimming pool of good karma pretty quick. Throw a plug hole. Okay. Careful. Pardon? It can do, because it's involved in self-view. Yeah? I have this much karma. Now, but a useful thing to do from time to time, and some people do it more often than others, and it's in more or less skillful ways, is actually remember the good karma that one has done and actually write it down in books. Yeah, so one can review it. And people, I think for maybe Westerners, that can get very, very much like tallying up a bank account. Yeah? But it can bring great joy. And I know people who do it, and do it very skillfully. The one that I'm thinking particularly of was one of the things that he did was give away one of his kidneys. So, and as a result, when he walks through life, he actually walks through life with a lot of confidence, because he knows that, as far as he's concerned, it doesn't matter if he dies or doesn't die. The karma that he's created has actually been quite healthy, even though it's maybe resulted in the loss of one of his kidneys. That sort of thing is, and he doesn't take it also sort of very personally. So, and that, and particularly remembering the good karma you've done, is really, really good when you feel down. When you feel, I have no right to be happy. Yeah? Then Mara's getting you. Yeah? And the story is that the Buddha, under the Bodhi tree, was feeling really, really alone. And because he'd made this resolve, tonight I'm going to get enlightened. Yeah? I'm going to sit here until complete enlightenment happens. And of course, you make a resolve like that, and of course, Mara comes running around. What right do you have to be enlightened? You're completely alone, nobody loves you. And what he did was he touched the earth. He touched the earth. And the earth goddess came up and wrung out her hair. She had long hair. And in wringing out her hair, all the water that had been poured on the earth when he dedicated the benefits of his good actions through his life came and flooded away the army of Mara. This is the Thai tale. And if you go to Ratanagiri, you'll see that picture of Mara's army on one side sort of charging up, and on the other side being completely flooded out. In the middle you see the picture of the earth goddess wringing out her hair. And what that's about is a recognition of the goodness of one's life, how that can actually it is possible. I've not done everything bad. It is possible to rise above this, even though it seems to be completely overwhelming. And what can sometimes do that for me is a sense of bowing, a sense of real bowing. I will. Whatever happens, I will learn from this. I really intend to let the truth be revealed, even though it's incredibly painful. This particular situation I'm in at the moment, I will bow in this situation, and this is all I can do. I just bow and bow to the Buddha in my heart, and may the truth be revealed. Now that's what I do. If there is a human birth, if you've got a human birth, you've got a human body, you've got a human, then you actually do have the right to be enlightened. Whether you are or not, it depends upon many conditions, but that is actually, you know, part of the birthright, which is why for Buddhists there's not a sort of original sin, there's original purity. Yeah, at one level or another, yeah. I'm not trying to make an absolute statement, but a human birth is that precious and has that potential.
Why is it so precious? What happens about humans?
Humans have really good capacity for making karma.
Either way.
Always. Now, elephants are pretty good creatures. Many creatures are pretty good creatures, but their capacity for independent intentional action is limited. They're driven a lot by instinct, not completely, but humans are least, you know, have the most capacity for overcoming that. Yeah. There's a distinction made in Thai between human animals and human beings. Human beings are ones are beings that keep the five precepts. Human animals. This question is apparently asked also to a Tibetan in America some years ago. How come, you know, if there's only, you know, how come there's so many more humans now than there were? You know, what's happened? What I heard was his reply was, "Where do you think the buffalo have gone?" No, I don't know. I'm not sure, but and somebody else, I think, asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama if you could be reborn as a mosquito. Yeah? And he said, possibly not, but maybe it's a swarm of mosquitoes. Yeah? I mean, yeah, these speculations are sometimes interesting, but I don't think we can find a sort of clear answer out of that. But I think if we treat this life that we do experience as precious, then what it gives me is a sense of urgency and a preciousness of it, a sense of wishing to treasure this and honor this. And if that's, and honor all life and all human life, and if that's the way that I use that concept, and I've got no idea about this purblind turtle who pops up once 100 years and can't see where the tractor tire is. But I like the scale in Buddhism, the scales of Buddhism I do like. You know, an aeon in Buddhism is you take a block of granite, 16 kilometers square, Yeah? And once every 100 years, the only thing that happens in this little, with this block of granite, nothing else is happening at all. There's no other causes acting on it at all. A dove flies across the top with a silk handkerchief in its beak. How long would it take for that block of granite to wear off? Quite a long time. It looks longer than, you know, all those noughts that you get in astronomy, yeah? It feels longer to me. And that's just one aeon. And there are many aeons. Yeah? I like that.
When you said elephants can be good,
yeah.
Do you just mean they're useful, or is there any sense in which anything other than karma, either human or animal, can have moral as
well? Well, it's something like the seeing eye dog. Mm-hmm. That is actually creating incredibly good karma. I mean, it's been trained to do it, but it's actually doing incredibly good karma. Yeah? Or sometimes you hear about dolphins or animals that save lives. They're creating incredibly good karma. You know, those animals are, you know, with what little they've got, they're using incredibly well. Yeah? You know, and that's very powerful. It'll last them in good stead for many aeons. To a certain extent, yes. The seeing eye dog actually is trained to have that intention and trained to look out for it. Animals do have karma, can make karma, it's just their capacity's less. Yeah? They have less self-awareness about what they're doing. A seeing eye dog does have some awareness about what it's up to. Working in its world of black and white and smells, it works its way through this peculiar universe that we live in. I don't know. Possibly not in exactly the way as humans do. But they do, you know, they do have intention. Somewhere there's intention. A goldfish doesn't have much. Yeah? But, you know, dogs do. You can see. You watch a cat or you watch a dog sometimes. They can also figure things out. Yeah, you know, and they do have intention. You know, they're limited. Their capacity for intention is less, you know, is less directed and less strong than human beings. We share a lot with animals. We're not somehow completely special. Yeah.
Is it our ability to introspect that enables us to be denoted?
I'm not 100% sure. It's our capacity to create karma, particularly the karma that leads to the end of karma, which is awareness. We can wake up to the whole business of what it is that we identify with. I mean, one of the joys of animals is they completely identify with where they're at and have absolutely no shame about it. Yeah? You know, but that's also very limiting. They don't have the perspective. Humans can go from heaven to hell. Yeah? Animals just, that's their... Their realm is very much where they're at. Whereas, you know, a dog, a seeing eye dog, actually has some perspective that there is another realm. Yeah? And there's a realm that I can move in for a period of time. It doesn't sustain that attention 24 hours a day, but for a period of time it acts in the human realm. It might, maybe. I've got no idea, but I, you know, there are many Jataka talks. I can't remember that one. The last one that I, the time before that I can recall, was that the birth before he was born as a Buddha was actually in the Tusita realm, as a Deva, the realm of the contented gods. But I can't remember all the Buddhist mythology in that. It sometimes confuses me. Because it's not very clearly set out. And you have to get, you have to read books. I can't see anything in Darwinian. The Darwinian way is one explanation of how things evolve and how things happen. It's an explanation. And even scientists accept that it's an explanation. And it, you know, it certainly has some basis in verifiable scientific facts. I'm not sort of arguing with it as a theory. It's a theory.
Just to turn to my other question about, you mentioned some things, some colours don't ripen, or some acorns fall and don't form an oak tree.
Yep.
So that's just maybe some colours don't necessarily ripen.
Yeah.
But how can you ensure that the good colours ripen? The very skillful colours. The realization.
It's to do with right effort. Yeah? And the right effort is not to act upon, not to repeat the patterns that are unskillful. Yeah? To nurture and develop those patterns that are skillful, that one already has. To learn from other people and not pick up unskillful habits that one does notice or hears about. The one that I say was the one that I do, which I did, which I regret, was for many years when I was a lay person, when I woke up, I got up. Yeah, that's what you do, you wake up, you get up. And then when I started living in monasteries, they started talking about how unskillful it was to, when you wake up, roll over and go back to sleep. Yeah? And I made a mistake. One day I thought, well, all these people are talking about it, I'll try it. Yeah? I'll roll over and go back to sleep. Very quickly I picked up a habit, which wasn't very skillful. So that was planting a weed in my garden. Yeah? Whereas, you know, it took over like ground elder. And whereas if I noticed a tree that I particularly liked and then planted that, then I put what effort it was to cultivate it. Now, one of the things that I did do was I heard about this thing called learning the Padimokkha. Yeah? And it's quite a long chant. And I thought, well, I'll try it. Now, some people can learn the Padimokkha in 7 days. I heard about this, you know, 7 days. 45 minute chant, quite fast. And one of the people who I became a monk with learnt it in 3 months. Okay. It was his first rains retreat as well. So I thought I'd try. It took me 18 months, and it was still terrible. It's okay now. But it took me an awful lot of effort to get down. Yeah? And I just kept plugging away. Just kept plugging away. If you hear of a skillful karma, like being generous, then figure out ways to practice it. You know, figure out ways to exercise it. Figure out ways for it to become something that flows without sort of needing to be able to even consider that you're doing it. Does that make? Does that help? Does that nail it down? For you. Not to have sex with people who are underage, not to have sex with people who are already spoken for, not to have sex with that's about it as it's stated. Okay? And it's not to have any sex. Mm-hmm. But you can see that that sexual energy is incredibly powerful, yeah? So how can you relate to that in ways that respect it? Because it makes other humans, yeah? It's powerful stuff. And is not exploitative. And you can misuse sexual energy even within a relationship. You know, you use it as a weapon, or you use it as... You can misuse the whole... That whole energy you can misuse, even within yourself. Yeah. So how do you relate to that sexual energy so that it's actually something that leads to ease and peace rather than confusion and pain? That's the sort of question that comes with that. Sexuality. Kame sumichajara vairatmani sikapadam. I think they're trying to say the same thing in a way that actually makes it a little bit more maybe dynamic. Because sexual misconduct does not preclude polygamy, it doesn't preclude polyandry or whatever it is. It doesn't make anything about that. It doesn't make judgments about that. If that's the way that the sexual mores are, then it doesn't make a big deal about it. Now, somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama can say that all homosexual activity is wrong. Yeah? And I can't get into that one, I don't know. I certainly, what is sexual energy about? How do you relate to it in ways that actually lead to a sense of peace? Because it's really very powerful. From time to time, it's good to practice celibacy. That's why the 8 precepts on Poya days on moon days is very traditional. So that once a week, or once a month, if you can only manage it once a month, on the form, you actually say, "Well, I will actually practice renunciation and not do anything sexually, just to see how that feels and works."
I read, Arjun, that in the normal human life, the normal regular sexual expression, the energy from the Muladhara chakra, the base chakra, frequently is released through sexual activity. When that's closed off, as in a period of celibacy, the energy is unable to move up through the chakras. Is there a Buddhist view on that? That's not specifically Buddhist.
Yeah, I don't think there's a Buddhist view on it. There's my view on it, but which might do, which is the practice of renunciation. Is helpful, and because it any sort of renunciation, if you're saying that I could do that, but I'm not going to, because it's actually unnecessary. Okay, people say, well, it's necessary for somebody to have sex. Well, I'm sure that not everybody's going to decide to be celibate tomorrow. Okay, I don't think that's a problem. If everybody just decides to keep the first precept then tomorrow, then even for a day, that would make a great deal of difference. Now, I don't think everybody's going to decide to keep the celibacy for the rest of the year, or the rest of their lives. So, but what it does give is a sense of, as you say, containment of energy, and that can give more, the energy is available for other things.
It's a powerful energy to transmute.
Yeah.
It's
a powerful. It makes other human beings. If there was something that was as powerful as sex, but wasn't sex, the only other thing that what we can't give up is food. Okay. But if there was something that was as powerful as sex, and as powerfully attractive as sex, I think the Buddha said that enlightenment would not be possible. It would just be too difficult to give up sex and something else that was as powerful as sex. One thing we can just about cope with. And there's food you can give up from one day to the next. You need it to a certain extent. Because food and sex, are on the great pools. Oh gosh.
Please explain.
An accident. Actually, it's a complete accident. A complete accident. There's a section in the Mahavagga, which is the first book of Buddhism that I read because I was really interested from the really beginning in the rules and regulations. And the Mahavagga is the best place to look at it. It's the first book of the Tripitaka. It's the Vinayapitaka. It's the first book of the Vinayapitaka. And chapter 8 of the Mahavagga, that's Book of the Discipline 4, okay, is a long chapter, and it deals with what are called medicines and the reasons that some things are allowed and some things aren't allowed. I think it's called the Mendicant Allowance. Do you really want this?
Well, you've honestly been asked before.
I have been asked before. And the best answer is actually it's an accident. It happens to be that in this particular time, in this particular place, there are arguments that can be found and can be supported that actually allow the idea of cheese and chocolate as being allowed in the afternoon. There are counter-arguments, and in some monasteries and many monks will say cheese is definitely unallowable. What's allowable is butter. Okay? No, but the thing is called Navanitang. Navanitang. And then how you get to Navanitang is hard work. And the one interpretation of this thing that is supposed to be able to last 7 days is cheese. So. And some of the monks and nuns that wander in India find something that they actually think is probably another Navanitang. And it's not very much like cheese, but it's reasonably like cheese, and it is made out of milk. Okay? Somewhere between butter and ghee or somewhere like that. And this is possibly what they meant was allowed. Okay? And chocolate. Dark chocolate for some reason, because it gives you headaches. That's why it's allowed. And it's a very stupid thing to eat. it's a type of bean, and it's possible that some sort of beans were allowed at the time of the Buddha. And although you see, cocoa wasn't around at the time of the Buddha, neither were chilies. Surprisingly enough, if you think about it. Chilies were not around at the time of the Buddha, because chilies come from Chile, and chili And Chile wasn't known about at the time of the Buddha, along with such things as papaya either. So they've had to figure out how to this strange thing that there were some things that were allowed, and it's possible that something, that the ingredients that happen to make up this peculiar headache-inducing substance what was allowed. In Thailand, they've got much better ideas about what's allowable and what's not allowable. And I think why I think actually cheese and chocolate are allowed is because Westerners like to think. Okay? And there were these strange Western monks in Wat Nanachat in 1975 and the early 70s, and they pored over these books and tried to figure out what they might be able to work out as being possibly technically allowed. And then they stuck us with this lot, which I completely know. So that's why I'm in.
Oh, Dan, is there any room for change in that?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes. An apple and a glass of milk. No. In that, I think that there are things that could be more healthy that could be worked out. And but one of the most healthy things would be not to bother at all, actually. But it's just really difficult. It's really difficult to give up eating, isn't it? Like sex. No, it's you know, it's just like almost habitual. Oh, easily. Easily. No. I survived for a long time in Thailand, and we hardly had ever had anything in the evening. You only eat once a day. You eat. Yeah, but no. It's possible. It's possible. It's
that.
Oh, yeah.
Something you said on Saturday, if you remember, it stuck in my mind. You weren't very happy about the universe at that time. You sort of mumbled something about the universe being unsatisfactory. And I think you said that Mara created the universe. Is
No. I think if I said anything is, Mara is that which delights in the creation of others. Because Mara is not a creator god. Mara is not a
creator god at all, do you?
Pardon?
You don't believe in a creator god at all.
No, there are many creator gods.
Oh, they do all sorts of things.
Yes. Yes, and they're not even the highest gods.
which of them created humans?
Oh, don't worry about that. They create all sorts of things. You know, you want to go and get a refund. I tell you who created the god. You know, the gods that created humans are other humans. You know, they're called, the parents are called gods in Buddhism.
Because it seems to me that the Buddha didn't like human bodies and stuff, and I read somewhere, somebody told me that he described the human body as a tumor with 9 holes in it. And I quickly counted the holes, and it is 9.
Because it oozes. Because it oozes. No, the.
You
just have to. Yeah. But the whole thing of looking at the body in different ways, as I think I described when I did talk about it, was to encourage flexibility and freedom. And but the way that
a single cell, a fertilized egg, in 9 months becomes a whole organism and grows to about 30 trillion cells, all coordinated, each cell a little factory making its own things and cooperating with all the 30 trillion. And to say that it's a tumor with 9 holes, I can't accept that.
Yeah. Yes, it's amazing. I don't think he was denying that either. He was saying it's really, really precious. So precious. But what that allows you to feel, what that allows you, is the whole range. So you're not concentrating on one thing at the expense of the other. Yeah. The thing is rejecting one. Yeah. You actually lose out on the possibility of actually appreciating the other.
Oh, no.
Fully.
Before the tumor, I really admire the human body because it's so fantastically coordinated.
And now you can't think of it as anything else.
Can generate consciousness and awareness. You'd call that a tumor with 9
holes. Is the mind in the body or the body in the mind?
No.
But somehow, nonetheless, wonderful though the body may be, I mean, in comparison with the absolute being, absolute consciousness, absolute bliss. I don't think that you even begin to compare.
Well, I've never experienced
it. Sorry, that's the point. That's the point.
To know what you believe is important. To know what you believe is important. And then to notice what effect that has. Because belief has an effect. Because you act from that. Your actions of thought, your actions of speech, your actions of your body, come from where you come from, your view, your paradigm. So to know what it is, and it's clear that you're clear about what you believe, and that's fine. And it has consequences. Yeah, and it yes.
That belief even enters into the Buddhist thing. The Buddha says, "Don't believe anybody or anything."
No.
He did.
No.
He said,
"That's Columbo."
Find out and see for yourself.
No, it's more complicated than that. The Kalama Sutra is more complicated than that.
May I just add something?
Yeah.
Wasn't that the meditation just to kind of counter an infatuation with
the It's a tool. And it's not an absolute statement. It's not saying it's the only way of viewing the body. It is a way of viewing the body. It is a way of looking at it. It is a way of approaching the body. The Kalama Sutra is more complicated than just saying don't believe anything. And because the Buddha actually established before he taught the Kalamas that they actually accepted the causality. They accepted the importance of creating good karma, and they accepted the importance of sila. When you actually read that sutta, he establishes that that's the base that he actually comes from. And then he says, when you listen to other teachers, starting from that base, because they were asking him what sort of, what teachers to believe and what teachers to not believe. Yeah? He said, starting from that base, then you can investigate. And don't just take what they say on trust. Yeah? But he established that they already had a basis of sila and a basis of causality before he made that statement. But that little statement is taken out of context. And it's very attractive for people who just want to believe whatever they want to believe.
Designed a machine, and you're talking about it's called perfection, it's a wonderful thing to behold, but it disintegrates.
Well, no, of course, it collapses. I'm not arguing about that, it's so obvious to
can
we saying, whilst it exists, why reduce it to skin, hair, teeth, and nails?
Can we just stop it being a debate for the moment? Because I think we can debate in a group of articulate and people have been quiet for a few days, it's going to get quite heated quite quickly, and we're about being cool here. So if we can live with that for a moment. There will be time to talk more and to debate more. The time now is more to just know if we can.
At some point, can you say something about insight meditation?
Insight? Yes, I can. Insight meditation is about insight into anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Any insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta is called vipassana. Any insight into that, so while sitting, if there's the knowing that what arises ceases, what arises in some way is also stressful, what arises is not self. Any insight into that is insight awareness, insight meditation. Even a breath. Yeah? It's
pain.
Huh? Pain. Pain. It's noticing the space around pain. Noticing the edges of pain. Noticing the way. With a headache, noticing how it throbs. Noticing how pain is sometimes sharp, sometimes lumpy. Finding a place that's quite comfortable and then moving in and out of it. And if the insight arises that this is uncertain, noticing when it ends, when you actually do shift posture. If it is possible that pain shifts. some pain doesn't shift. Some emotional pains take time and need further examination, a sense of willingness to actually go right into it, bow right into it, is sometimes necessary. Observing is the key, the Buddha is the key. The knowing is the key. When if it's physical pain when you're sitting, awareness within the body of physical pain can produce shifts in the body, yeah? Which will allow that pain to ease in and of itself. And the shifts may be very, very small. And almost imperceptible, because you're not trying to hold the whole thing. You're allowing this body, which is always moving anyway, to find its own balance. Because actually the body doesn't want to experience pain. It's not out here to torture you in some way. It's not out to torture itself. Does that help? Yeah. Well, if you see it as anicca, dukkha, anatta, then it's vipassana. That's what vipassana means. It means insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta. Investigating an emotion, investigating any of the five khandhas: form, feeling, perception, conception, consciousness. Any insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta is vipassana. Any insight into the five khandhas. Samatha is calming. Samatha and vipassana. The two sides are the same thing. You can't the insight can't be there without the other, without the calm. Calm can't be there without the insight. Samatha and vipassana. They're not somehow different.
Enlightenment is achieved only through vipassana, isn't
it? Vipassana is insight into the three characteristics. Insight into the three characteristics is liberating, but you can't have samatha without vipassana. So you can't have vipassana without samatha. You can't have vipassana without samatha, you can't have samatha without vipassana. The two go together. Yeah? And you can't have, that's why some people say, well, you can't have vipassana without jhana. Yeah? Because it's a samatha. You can't have samatha without vipassana. You can't have jhana without some sort of insight, without some sort of relinquishment. You can't have. It might or might not. But you see, the thing is, the degree of sharpness of insight, of vipassana, depends on the strength of the samatha. The degree also of samatha depends a lot on the degree of vipassana. The two go together. Oh. That sounds complicated. Just calming. It's true that as insight, some insight develops, some confidence develops, sometimes for some people they get really, really interested in dukkha. pain is only one form of dukkha. Yeah? Because there's also mental anguish, which is can be made. Pain is usually just confined to physical pain, in this sense. The mental anguish can produce physical pain, yeah? And physical pain can produce mental anguish. So, an interest in dukkha is something that is helpful, because the degree to which one knows dukkha is the degree to which one's prepared to abandon the causes, is the degree to which one realizes cessation, and is the degree to which one is practicing the path. Does that help? What isn't considered helpful is actually torturing yourself. That's called self-mortification. That isn't considered helpful. You don't need to go and seek any more pain than you already do have. But you can be interested in the pain that you already have. For some people, their progress is very slow and incredibly painful. Yeah? For some people, their progress is incredibly slow, but not so painful. For some people, their progress is incredibly painful but fast. For some people, their progress is incredibly fast and not painful. Now, whenever you say something about some people, there's always the mind goes, well, I wonder which one I am. And don't believe any of it. You're none of them. You're none of them. It's just a way of talking. Yeah? Yeah. It's this thing, am I a Leo? Sajjan Samedo is one, isn't it? No, I'm not a Leo. Okay. But, you know, or you get, you know, any sort of classification of person, be really, really, really careful about that. Because it's not sure. It's not a sure thing. But it's interesting that there are those classifications. You do meet different people who you think, oh, they seem to have it easy. But maybe that's just that particular time at that particular place in that particular situation. Another situation, another time, another place, another situation. Different person. Probably enough for this evening. I've not even covered most of these, but it's a sort of pause here that we can, because I think if I just let it run on, it would run on till midnight now.